Let's start with your latest article on empire decline and costly delusions. You talk about this conflict in Ukraine and the complexity of this issue that we're witnessing with Russia, the West, NATO. And could you elaborate on this article? Because I found it so important for our audience.
Well, first of all, thank you for your kind words about it. I wrote it because of my concern that the level of miscalculations involved in this war have to be explained. I mean, there are many aspects of this war, and I know you have explored them with various guests, and you will continue to do so, and that's an important service. But I want to pose and answer a question. And the question is, there were terrible miscalculations made, and I want to explore them. Let me begin by explaining what I mean. Early in the war, and even before the war, Russia had indicated that it considered this a threat to its security and safety, the possibility that Ukraine would join the economic union, the European Union, and also NATO. And then when they made the decision to invade, which they did in February of 2022, we know that there were statements, there were meetings, and there were negotiations early in the war to bring it to an end before it could do terrible damage either to Ukraine or to Russia or to both of them. But those failed. And we know that there was a role played by British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who went to Kiev and persuaded Zelensky, or at least that's the best sense I can make of it, not to sign an agreement, not to work something out with the Russians. Okay, then the war begins in earnest, and I know from the United States and from other countries too, that the following miscalculations were made and articulated. Number one, that Russia was weak and could be defeated militarily, even by a much smaller country, Ukraine, if it got support from Western Europe and America. Number two, that one of the objectives was to bring, I quote, bring Russia to its knees and or, quote, break Russia up into smaller national units, like Ukraine, for example, and so on. Then the calculation was made that the Russian ruble would collapse. Then the calculation was made that the Russian economy would collapse. It could not sustain for any length of time a war. I could go on, but these were all shown to be huge miscalculations. Why? Because Russia showed that it can wage a war of attrition, that it can do so better than the Ukraine, and it can do it better than the Ukraine with Western arms and Western financial support. For anyone who isn't blind, the Russians have won somewhere between a fifth and a quarter of the Ukraine territory, which they now control. And if anything, they look stronger than they did a year ago, and Ukraine looks weaker than it did a year ago. The Russian ruble has not collapsed. The Russian economy is doing better in 2023 than it did in 2022, and is continuing to perform better in 2024 after 3 months than it did a year ago. So the military calculations, the economic calculations were mistakes. Now, finally, the political calculations. Despite an enormous media effort to portray the Russians as war criminals, to demonize Mr. Putin as another incarnation of Stalin and Hitler and all the rest of it, votes in the United Nations have been showing that the political support around the world for Russia is as strong or stronger than it is for Ukraine. So I see here a monumental miscalculation economically, militarily, and politically. And I find that the thing to explain more than what happens on the military battlefield or what even happens in the United Nations or even what happens in the global economy. What in the world made the collective West, the United States and Western Europe and Japan, agree to a level of calculations which undergirded their decision to fight a war? And this is of crucial importance to understand how and why this happened. And if you're wondering, why is it important? Because it has already led to the literal destruction of Ukraine. I mean, the economy there will not recover for years. Something between a quarter and a half of the population have left Ukraine, and millions of them will not come back. The combination of the military destruction and the economic destruction and the exodus of millions of their citizens are major catastrophes for Ukraine. Okay, so the damage done here, and I won't even discuss all of the dead people and all of the wounded people on both the Ukraine side and the Russian side, which number in the hundreds of thousands at least. These are catastrophic. And as if that weren't bad enough, miscalculations like these, if they are not corrected, if they are not explained so that they can be corrected, will be made again. And we will see other related miscalculations with equally horrible consequences. If we had time, and perhaps we can do this on another occasion, I would show you that what is going on in Gaza is another similar miscalculation, in this case by the Israelis, about both the military, political, and economic resources that Hamas actually has. And this is not a question of whether you agree or disagree with what happened on October 7th or what has happened since. Those are important questions, and I respect them. But I'm asking a different question. What kind of miscalculation led Israel to do something which, in my own opinion, in the long run, is worst of all for Israel? But we stay here with Ukraine. All right, here's my answer to why the miscalculations have happened. It lies in something you and I have discussed before, but I want to bring it forward now for people to think about. Every empire in the history of the world has been born, developed, and then passed away, usually giving rise to another empire that was emerging as the old one was declining. That was true of the Roman Empire, the Greek Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the Persian Empire, and I could continue. In the 18th and 19th century, it was the rise and fall of the British Empire, which happened right after the much briefer rise and fall of the Dutch or the Netherlands Empire. And in the 20th and 20th, into the early parts of the 21st century, we saw the rise of the American Empire out of the decline of the British Empire. All right, here's my argument. The American Empire was born, some people say, in the aftermath of the American Civil War. Some people say only at the time of World War I. And some people wait until World War II. But you can disagree about when, but no one disagrees the empire emerged after World War II. It systematically replaced the dying old empires of Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and so on. And so we've seen in the last 70 years, the rise, the peaking of the American Empire. It has variously been called the American Empire, the American century, the unipolar moment, American hegemony. Lots of people have understood its birth and its rise. Now we come to my proposition. It is now in decline. It has been in decline for the last 20 years, roughly from the crash of 2008 and 2009, from which I would argue we will date the decline of the American Empire. It had been hoped that it would never again see a terrible economic crash like the one we had in the 1930s. But the crash of 2008 and 2009, and then again the crash of 2020, even though they were called subprime mortgage crash or they were called COVID-19 crash, these were actually crashes as bad as the one in 1929. The crash in 2020 threw half the American labor force out of work, some for only a few weeks, some for a month or a year. But a half of the labor force losing its job, that's even worse. At the peak of the Great Depression of the 1930s, in 1933, American unemployment was 25%, and that was considered catastrophic. It's true, the 2020 crash did not last 10 years the way the one in 1929 did. It was shorter, but it was deeper. And these were crashes that were supposed to not happen. They were supposed to have been put away by the reforms enacted after the 1930s crash, by the development of Keynesian economics, which was supposed to include the monetary and fiscal policies to prevent, to minimize anything like the crash. They were shown to be insufficient. That's what we've learned in the last 14 years, at least. Next, we have learned that the United States cannot master being the world's policeman. It cannot do it, even though it has 700 military bases around the world, even though it is very rich as countries go, and even though it has the most developed military in the world. Here is the reality. It was brought to a stalemate in Korea in 1950-51. It lost the war in Vietnam in 1970s. And it lost the war in Afghanistan to the Taliban, who now run that country, like the Communist Party of Vietnam ran the country after the defeat of the United States in 1975. And the United States effectively lost the war in Iraq because the dominant influence over there is now Iran, which was not the objective of the American intervention. And my guess is, unless something happens that I don't see, we are about to see the loss of the war in Ukraine as well. All right. These are signs of empire decline. They have always been signs of empire decline when the empire suddenly discovers it cannot afford and it cannot win endless battles around the periphery of the empire to protect it. That's what's happening. The American empire was global, very ambitious, but that requires a global military presence. And that proved to be more than the United States could undertake. And now finally, the most important issue of all. It's economics. The reality in the United States is that for the last 25 to 30 years, the American economy has grown poorly. It has averaged a GDP increase of around 2 to 3%, depending a little bit on how you count. Over that time, another economic unit, the People's Republic of China, has achieved annual rates of GDP growth between 6 and 9%. In other words, 2 to 3 times what the United States did, meaning that the gap between the United States and China is closing, and closing fast. I believe I have given you in the past, but it's worth repeating. The GDP of the United States and its major allies, the G7, added all together, is about 29% of total GDP in the world. The GDP of People's Republic of China and its allies in the BRICS is now 33% of the world's total output. The year 2020 was when the two lines crossed. Before 2020, the United States and its allies was the bigger economic unit. Since 2020, China and its allies are the bigger economic unit, and the gap between them grows each year. Today, as we speak, the British economy is in recession. Today, as we speak, the German economy is in recession. The American economy is growing maybe again 2-2.5%. The Chinese economy is growing at 2 to 3 times that rate. Even though it's a poor time, the Chinese have many economic problems. But the gap is narrowing. The GDP of China is now estimated, depending on how you count, in the neighborhood of $17 to $18 trillion. The American GDP is $23 trillion. That's a very small difference. The GDP of Russia right now, $1.5 trillion. Russia is a small economic entity. China is enormous. And China and Russia together, even before we add Brazil and India, I mean, we are talking about a whole new world economy in which the declining wealth and power is the G7 and the rising wealth and power are the BRICS. The miscalculations in Ukraine can be traced to the inability of the United States and Western Europe to face the reality. They are in what psychologists call mass denial. And that's why they miscalculated. They didn't understand that if they didn't buy Russian oil and gas, BRICS would. And that's what happened. BRICS purchased the oil and gas from Russia, and therefore everything that the West had counted on didn't happen. The BRICS also mobilized the rest of the world. China's wealth has enabled them to help half the countries in Africa with major investments, major loans. When then the Chinese want support for their view of the war in Ukraine, they get it. That's exactly what used to happen for the United States. But it doesn't happen now because there's an alternative for every country in Asia, Africa, and Latin America that has a problem. It can go to the United States, but it doesn't have to. It can go to London or Paris or Rome or Berlin or Tokyo, but it doesn't have to. It can go to Delhi. It can go to Beijing. It can go to Sao Paulo. And it has more resources in the latter than in the former. Had the people who make the decisions been able and willing to face what I've just said, they would have saved themselves the miscalculations that have now destroyed Ukraine and threatened more horrible damage if these miscalculations continue. There are, finally, forces in the world that are working for continued miscalculation and against it. I didn't have the chance to develop this last point in the article you refer to, so maybe I can briefly mention it here. The neocons, the right-wing governments that govern in most Western European countries, certainly in Germany, in France, in Italy, and in Britain, France, Germany, and Italy, and also the United States, and also Japan. There are strong forces there that will continue these miscalculations. They're the kind of thinking that supports Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel as if that were the only immediately reasonable thing to do, and to stay with him even in the months since October 7th. And they're terrible miscalculations that threaten the whole world. But there's another force, and it was on display this week, even today, in Beijing, where you see many of the leading CEOs of the largest American corporations, Apple Computer, Google, and many others, in Beijing, meeting with Xi Jinping. Why? Because these large corporations, over the last 23 years, have invested hundreds of billions of dollars in China. They don't want to lose this investment. They went to China because the wages are lower and it's the fastest growing market in the world. And as all capitalists have always understood, your chances of success depend on going where the wages are low and the market is growing. And they went there and they profited enormously. And so did China. They want that to continue. So the real struggle may appear to be Russia, China, US, but it isn't. The real struggle is right here in the United States, and to a lesser degree in Europe, between those industries, those corporations that need and want a continued relationship with China, the export industries upon which Germany depends, and it's the strongest economy in Europe. They need that relationship with China. And so do the Americans. So it's a struggle inside those countries between the old war, Cold War mentality, the hostility to everything socialist and communist, the neocon notion that the West is forever hegemonic, those people versus the corporate majority who either are already dependent on China or want to be, because that's where their future is. That's where the profits lie. That's where their competitors are busy, and they know they better be there too. And under the headlines, that's the battle being fought out.
I think one of the important countries in Europe is Germany. There is an article recently in Financial Times. It says that wars in Ukraine and Middle East boost orders at German defense supplier. It simply says that Germany is benefiting from Ukraine and Gaza. It seems to me that they're trying to shift the focus of German economy, the glory of German economy, on their military. We know the last time they were focused on their military, how it ended up. Why they're trying to do this to Germany, in your opinion?
Well, it's all that Germany knows. Let me be blunt with you. And in case anyone's wondering, my first language is German. I speak German fluently, and I have all my life, and I follow the affairs of Germany. Germany was catastrophically hit by the Great Depression in 1929. Without that depression, it would never have happened that Hitler was given the government in January of 1933. The collapse in Germany was catastrophic between 1929 and 1933. And this catastrophe followed a slightly earlier catastrophe in 1923, when Germany had one of the worst inflations in the history of the world, where the currency became useless, where the collective savings of the mass of the German people was wiped out. And that came just a few years after Germany lost World War I. So in a very short time, we're talking here 10, 15 years, Germany lost the World War, suffered the worst inflation in world history, and the Great Depression. It was too much. It was a trauma of misery, of suffering, of unemployment, of a crash of the whole society, not just the economy. And what pulled them out of that situation was the rearmament of Germany undertaken by Hitler. This is obviously not an endorsement of Hitler. Hitler was a horrible leader. I have nothing but hatred for everything he represents. But not to understand this is to make, again, the same miscalculation. So the Germans learned that the armaments industry and the government focused on prioritizing that can help them out of bad situations. Okay, now they have a bad situation. The thing that gave Germany its edge for the last 25 years was the combination of very cheap energy from Russia and an advantage in a unified market, because their heavy industry had developed further than that of the other parts of Europe, France, Britain, Italy, and so on. So they could have a special place in the unified market of Europe and the cheapest energy to serve that market. Okay? So they now have lost that. That is a catastrophe for them. That's why, for the first time in many, many years, they are having a recession. Two quarters of negative economic growth, the literal definition of a recession. They lost. It's hurting them terribly. It's scrambling their society. It's disrupting their politics. They have a very unstable government because of it, etc. Now, is it true that some of the defense orders that are coming from the war in Ukraine and the war in Gaza are helping some German engineering company? Of course. But the reason you read that in the Financial Times is the struggle going on inside Germany, like in the United States, between all the industries hurt by what's going on, hurt by the rise in the cost of energy that makes Germany uncompetitive with other countries that didn't depend on Russian oil and gas as much as the Germans did. Those industries are hurt. Likewise, the industries that used to have a market in Russia and don't anymore. Those industries are struggling to change German policy. Then there are the political right-wing, Cold War, center-right governments that want to hold on to the anti-Russia, want to hold on to the alliance with the United States, are afraid of what will happen to them or to Europe if they don't. They don't want to go make a deal with China, although that's coming. So they don't do that yet. They're torn between Russia and the United States. And for 50 years, they've gone with the United States. So they want to hold on to all of that. They don't want to see the decline of the West or of the United States because it's literally losing their own foundation. So they want to continue. And they want to make sure that publications like the Financial Times put on the front for the mass of the Germans to read, we are benefiting in some ways from Gaza. We are benefiting in some ways from Ukraine. It's true, they are. But that's because they are fighting these two sides. And make no mistake, it's a tremendous fight. It will determine whether the Olaf Scholz government survives. That's what's happening right now, just as it will determine and is determining the very possibility of another Trump administration here in the United States. That's the fight, but it's the fight of an empire that's going down, that's declining, that doesn't know how to solve that problem, that does not want to work out with China how to live and let live. Let me remind everyone, when the United States decided to break away from its position as a colony of Great Britain, there were two wars that the British fought to prevent that. The Independence War of 1776, and then another war in 1812. Both times the British were sure they would win. They were bigger, they were richer, they were more armed. And they were defeated to their surprise, just like the United States was defeated to its surprise. So the British then decided we can't force this, and they came to an accommodation. The United States has to decide, will you continue to try to stop, prevent, undercut, smash the Chinese economic machinery? You haven't succeeded so far. And I don't think you're going to. It's not the way history usually goes. The betting will not be on your side. Maybe you better decide to work something out. Believe me, if and when that happens, there will be enormous support, which should surprise no one, from many parts of Britain, France, Italy, Germany, Canada, and Japan, who will benefit from that alternative way of figuring out what to do. And they won't make the same miscalculations that are catastrophic, and they always have been. You know, in the decline of the Roman Empire, it was fashionable for Romans to refer to the people on the edges of their empire as barbarians. They were known as the barbarians threatening the empire. It turned out that those barbarians were stronger than the Romans, and they ended the empire. How different is it if we call Xi Jinping or Mr. Putin, or we can call them every name in the book, demonize them, they're horrible. It's silly. It's not dealing with the underlying realities that are governing the situation in the end.
Richard, just to wrap up this session, in your opinion, are we heading toward a new Cold War, or you see something worse than that?
I think what we're seeing now is an experiment led by the United States a desperate experiment to see if we can use a revived Cold War against China and its allies that will give us the period of prosperity that we enjoyed as a nation in the first Cold War. The first Cold War was a period of the American Empire's rise. You could even date the American Empire from the Russian Revolution in 1917 for the next 100 years. That was the period of the growth of the empire. So it's understandable, like in the story I told you about Germany, that they would once again see, well, when we demonized Stalin and we said the Cold Russians were the evil communists trying to take over the world and all of that, even though Russia never was even a small kind of economic competitor for the United States. Never, ever. The Soviet Union was tiny relative to the United States. Never had the power, the size, the wealth that the Chinese have. He says completely different. But, you know, you have to face that reality if you're going to calculate on that basis. So I think the United States is making an experiment, hoping that a revived Cold War, now aimed at China and Russia, that ignores the fact that the socialism of Russia was overthrown and that Putin is the enemy of that part of Russian history. Ignore all of that, because that's what you need to deny what's going on. If you accepted that Putin is the negation of the Soviet history, you'd have to ask other questions. Why are we fighting him? We were supposed to be having a war between capitalism and communism, between the United States and the Soviet Union. Why are we at war with the internal leader who opposed and overthrew the Soviet system? But they don't. This has to be negated. Most Americans don't even know that this is the case. So an experiment is made. And if you want my guess about the future, and that's all we can ever do, I think they will discover, I think they are already discovering that that experiment is a mistake. It is not working. The conditions have changed. Russia is not China, and the world is not divided that way. It's over. And I think, therefore, there's not much left for the United States. They can try militarily to control the situation, but that invites nuclear war, and none of this is worth that. You're not going to win that between the Russians, who probably have the greatest nuclear arsenal in the world, and the Chinese, who have the second or third biggest one. This is suicide, and I don't believe that this is likely to be the policy. So I think with much difficulty, much fakery, much dishonesty, there will be the recognition to work this out. And because the corporate leaders of America include many that want that to happen, I think the chances of that emerging after a difficult intermediate period, I think those are coming soon. But they may require also big political changes, tremendous shifts inside the G7, from politics of the right to a politics of the left, that there will be a rejection of what has been the political norm in Western Europe, North America, and Japan, and a reversion to the kind of New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt, solving the problems in a completely different way, that will be more likely the outcome, my guess, than any of the others.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Richard.
My pleasure, Nima. And thank you for producing these programs and distributing them. It's a very, very important service, and it is not being done by very many people around the world. So my hat is off to you, and I'm sure your audience agrees that these are valuable discussions you're not going to find elsewhere.